The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
The oceans of the world were the home of Big Blue. He was the greatest monster that the world ever knew. And the place that he loved best was the waters to the west. Around the blue Pacific, he did roam. This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates the work of Gordon Lightfoot song by song, a proud member of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and along with me is a fellow Lightfoot fan making her, my goodness, eighth appearance on the show, Deb Radwan. Deb, welcome back. It's great to talk with you again.
Thanks. I enjoy this so much.
Now, today we're talking about Ode to Big Blue, which is not among his best-known songs, but one that also got a decent amount of concert play. So I guess what I'm wondering is, why did you want to talk about that one in particular today?
Well, anyone who knows me knows that I'm a huge whale lover. I've been down to Baja. I've pet them. I've kissed them. I've probably been out on boats hundreds of times. I've seen blue whales up close and personal. They are enormous. They are gentle. When you look at one in the eye, and this is really with any whale, but because of the enormity of the blues, when you look at them in the eye, it's like you're looking into the universe. It is a spiritual experience. For me, there seems to be some connection. They are just amazing. And when you hear them blow, it's one of the most beautiful sounds there is. They are just so powerful and big and majestic. And they live for 100 years and they just have my heart. And so when Gord wrote this song and I heard it, it really touched me because I'm all about protecting the whales and respecting them. And I was so glad that he found this a worthy topic for a song.
And we're going to talk a little bit about what motivated him to write it. Do you have a special anecdote or a particular instance or story about how the song impacted you? We've talked about the idea of your mindset in terms of the ocean and in terms of blue whales, but the song in particular, is there an event where it really hit home?
Well, not so much an event. It's just the idea of drawing attention to their plight. He's so good, and I know we'll talk more about this, but with the words and the instrumentation conveying the power of these animals, this is one of those songs that really, it's like an onomatopoeia. It sounds like the whale, even though whales don't make a sound except for their blow, but that driving force and the music and the message, and I just love it.
And I don't blame you at all. And my wife has a particular affinity to this because she grew up on the coast and literally like 30 feet from the surf.
Wow.
So she is familiar with this.
Right.
I think for me, it's a little less personal, although I certainly appreciate the idea of preserving nature, and I'm dead set against anybody who wants to wipe out a species. But I think more generally for me, it's just reinforcing this idea that Gord was impacted by nature. He was obviously very conscious of it. And maybe he had a little resentment towards the hunting of whales for sport, and maybe just the whole idea of whaling. And I figure that anybody who's written a song about Don Quixote probably has read that book and has probably read Moby Dick, too. I think there's a good chance that although he's never alluded to that specifically, what about a locale for you to be listening to this song? Is this something that I'm going to have this particular set of circumstances where this is just going to be the soundtrack of that experience? Or could you listen to this at any time?
Oh, no. All the time. Anytime. Probably I listen to it mostly in my car, but anytime, and especially if I'm on my way to go whale watching or have just gone whale watching, you know, it's particularly poignant, but I could listen to it all the time. In my mind, it's a masterpiece.
Oh, yeah. For me, I would want to listen to this in the coffee house, unless there was, like, I was sitting at a cafe overlooking the sea, and it was a warm day, and, you know, I wasn't going to be freezing with the winds coming off the ocean, and somebody was playing it live, or if I had my headphones on. Those would be the two real scenarios for me. Going back to the origins of it, this is what Lightfoot said about the song, and I'm quoting directly. A lot of people were killing whales at that time, so I thought it was time to write a sort of protest song. Environmental activism was kind of swelling in the early 70s, and then it subsided. Singers like John Denver got involved in the movement back then, but I didn't really step into the fray on that front until about 1989. End of quotation. Now, we also know that Gord was really into seafaring songs, and he wrote a bunch of them. And Christian Island is also on the Don Quixote record, which talks about his love for the sea. And we've done that on the show, I think, in our first season. Do you have any other insight as to how the song got written, when it got written, what motivated him, anything like that?
You know, I don't, other than two forces, I think, in Gord's life, and that was his love of nature and particularly of the ocean. You have Christian Island, Whispers of the North, Ringneck Loon, Seven Islands Suite, Triangle, all these songs that have a nautical theme. He did love the ocean, and he loved being on it. He loved steering his boat. So I think that was one of the things that was innate in him, that when he heard about this, it probably propelled him toward writing a song. But also, you know, we don't think of Gord as writing protest songs or things like a Bob Dylan. But in reality, he has quite a few. He had Ode to Big Blue. He had Black Day in July. He had Cherokee Bend. Even Too Late for Praying, he's making a statement. The war song, Sit Down, Young Stranger, Home from the Forest. So he does have a catalog of songs that are protesting something. And I think Ode to Big Blue was just another one of those concerns and causes that he wanted to write about. Even on that album, Patriot's Dream, another kind of protest song. I think that was just part of who he was. And that whole album is so rich anyway, but you got a couple protest songs, you got a couple ocean songs. And I think that just speaks to who he was and what he loved.
And it certainly proves that his conscience was not restricted to just one set of values. I mean, there are a lot of things that he really cared about. This is, I suppose, a subtle sort of protest song. I think it's more of a fable than anything else, because it does sort of have a beginning, middle, and end, but it doesn't go in. You don't learn anything about Big Blue except the facts.
That's exactly the same way in Cherokee Bend. It's a message song, but he tells it through storytelling.
And I'm old enough to remember that there was an environmental movement, and Greenpeace was a big part of that in the early 70s and the mid 70s. But by the time we get to the 80s, people are laughing at it, frankly, because it has become repetitious. It's become a little bit cliched. It's because people are looking at it as hackneyed, all of those kinds of things. It's unfortunate, but that's the way people's fashions worked. And in the 80s, it was very easy to mock what happened in the 60s, because that was a generation where people wanted to pretend like the 60s never happened. Yeah. You want to pretend like everything just the way it was in the 50s. So let's take a look at the lyrics a little bit. The oceans of the world were the home of Big Blue. He was the greatest monster that the world ever knew. And clearly we're talking about a blue whale. It's interesting that they're talking about blue whales as monsters, because blue whales are absolutely harmless to humans. And if they do harm to humans, it's more or less accidental. They're certainly not predators. on humans. So do you think it was just they were called monsters just because of their sheer size that they were
It's just a reference to their enormity. They're 200 tons. They can grow 100 feet. Their tongues are as big as a school bus. So I think that reference to monster is just about how big they were.
So the word monstrous, meaning their size, not necessarily their character.
Right. Okay. I think so.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Radio is so much different than it was in the 80s. We had it all. The music, the movies, the DJs, and morning shows. Back to the 80s Radio is a show from the 80s in podcast form. We bring the memories from that awesome decade back. Join Toscano and Chang every Friday as they take you on a ride back in time, sharing their experiences and laughs. Stop on by and discover some of the wacky things this crazy duo comes up with. They talk about it all, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the greatest decade. Don't miss the greatest 80s podcast in the world. Back to the 80s Radio.
Is that song really a cover? What instrument are they playing there? What do those crazy lyrics mean? If you're the kind of person who thinks about stuff like that, you're in luck because I've got just the podcast for you. How Good It Is chooses a single song each episode and takes a dive into the story behind the song and the artist who made it famous. I'm Claude Call. You can find me in your favorite podcast software or just point your browser to howgooditis.com. How good it is.
And the place that he loved best was the waters to the west around the blue Pacific he did roam. Well, that's accurate because blue whales are usually found in the Pacific. The interesting thing is that Gord is from Eastern Canada and did not grow up anywhere near the Pacific Ocean. So I'm wondering, and we may never know this, but I'm wondering if he was talking about this just completely from his spirit and whatever he had read about it, or whether he'd actually seen whales in the Pacific.
I don't think so, but I guess no one would know for sure. I don't think so. I think this is strictly from reading about it, hearing about it, hearing about their plight, being impressed with their size, the enormity. It's funny. They're the largest animal to ever grace the earth, and they eat the smallest animal to ever grace the earth. All they eat is krill, which are smaller than little shrimp. They're fascinating animals, and I think he probably just fell in love with that.
Yeah, and there's what's not to love, really, because of everything that we understand about them.
That's right.
And you mentioned some of the statistics. I'll mention just a couple here. It is the largest animal known ever to have existed. They can go from 72 feet long to 102 feet long. 102, I think, is the largest they've ever measured. And then weight from 220,000 pounds. And then the biggest one, I think, was 247,000 pounds. That's really big. For someone who lives in the interior of whatever continent, they've never been to the surf and they don't appreciate the ocean, much less live near the Pacific as you and I do. If they see those numbers, it may bring it home to them a little bit more, but I think it is something that you have to, at the very least, see a video or see the proportions to understand that.
I agree. I think talking like 200 tons or whatever, that's hard to fathom. But when you say that their tongue was the size of an elephant or a school bus, and their heart was the size of a small car, you can relate to that. Oh, geez, that's big.
Yeah, I'm glad that you used those analogies because the numbers themselves don't tell the whole story. Big Blue moved alone, for a mighty blue was he, and the battles of the whales was an awesome sight to see. I don't know if I got the agreement there, which is interesting because blue whales don't typically fight with each other, except on very rare occasions. So rare as to be pretty much unobservable.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm wondering is Gord using some poetic license here, or is there a fight going on here between a blue whale and some other animal?
No, I think there's some artistic license happening. and maybe he's borrowing from another species. Like humpbacks, when they're courting a female, they will engage in fights. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a Tarzan thing. They do all kinds of things to pound their chest to show the female, I'm the better man. So he might have been borrowing from another species, but in general, blue whales are loners. They travel pretty much alone. They don't fight with one another. I think it's just artistic license.
Yeah. I mean, he talks later in that same verse, driving them all away. And it's typical of males in all parts of the animal kingdom to compete with each other, in some cases to the death, to find a female. But blue whales, extremely gentle creatures. So yeah, thanks for clearing that up. Big Blue had 50 wives and he sired 40 sons. That's also accurate because blue whales tend to mate every couple of years after they get to be a certain age. I don't know exactly how old, but that fits in the math. He lived about 100 years. Okay, we divide that by two. Probably he was with 50 females, gave birth to 40 sons, although I don't know how much of a father-son relationship it is if he's swimming around the whole place. So he's not necessarily going to stick around, you know, for his progeny. And that's animals. I understand that.
That's right. The baby whales stay with the mother for a period of time, and then they're off on their own.
Though most of them fell victim to the cruel harpoon guns. Well, we know that whaling ships hunted whales for years for sport or for other things. And now, some ridiculous percentage, maybe 100% of the things that we used to get, we, the human race, used to get from whales can now be made synthetically. I don't know if it's 100%, but way over 90% can now be made in a laboratory. We don't need to slaughter these creatures any longer.
Although Iceland, Japan, and Norway still do commercial whaling.
You know, that was my next question, is how much commercial whaling is still going on, because they are an endangered species. And I'm going to talk more about that in a second or two. Let's make sure we got it. Iceland, Japan. What was the third one?
Norway.
Norway. Mm-hmm. And are they doing that for sport, as far as you know, or are they doing that to harvest resources? Not that one is any better than the other.
I don't think it's for sport, and I don't think it's necessarily blue whales. Although I think if there's a blue whale, they're going to go after it for the blubber or whatever. But I know like sperm whales have that bulbous front of the head, and that forehead area that has oil that is used in things like candles and kerosene and whatever. So I think sperm whales are still hunted for that oil. But I think really it's just blubber. I'm not sure what they do with it. I think some whales, they used to eat some of it. I don't think that's really practiced anymore. So I'm not sure why they're doing it. And I don't think it's as prevalent. There's just a lot of international pressure to stop, but it does happen.
Well, it's such an ugly practice. I don't want to get into all hunting. I mean, that's is story for another day, but to slaughter these creatures, which are no threat to any human, I understand and sympathetic with people who believe that this is just evil, this is wrong, this needs to stop. Gordon obviously believed that too. Ah, but he was much too wise to get caught by the gunner's eyes, and so he lived at sea 100 years. Now, that implies that he knew something that his kids didn't know, or that other whales weren't hip to, because whales, as far as we know, don't have that extrasensory perception. They don't have this idea, okay, they look at something and say, oh, that's a whaling ship, as opposed to that's the love boat coming their way. So he's kind of personifying a little bit here. He lived at sea 100 years. Okay, blue whales will live on the outside about 80 to 90 years. They're known to live 100 years or more. I don't know what the oldest one is, but again, that's scientific accuracy. And so I've got to think that he picked that up. He could probably read that in a National Geographic magazine. His mouth was as large as a tunnel, so they say. His hide was thick as leather and his eyes quick and small. And his back was all scarred by the times he got away. So that shows that he had had some close shaves. He'd never been caught, but he'd certainly been attacked. And he had managed to make his escape for whatever reason. So he had knowledge of it, but there's no reason for us to think that he knew the difference, as I said, between a whaling ship and an ocean liner. And he knew the smell of whalers did Big Blue. Okay, well, whales don't have a sense of smell, but again, it's personification. Right. Big Blue passed away to his natural decay beside the Arctic Circle as he traveled up that way. Okay, good. He died of old age. He did not die at the hands of a human being. Now, there are graveyards where whales go to die. We know about this. I mean, we know that elephants have the same kind of thing. There's not a whale graveyard technically in the Arctic Circle. There is one that's off the coast of Chile, which is can be very close to Antarctica. But as far as we know, there's not a whale graveyard in the Arctic Circle. So again, I think he's playing a little bit around here with the imagery.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Have you checked out the Dilettantes? It's a podcast full of smart conversations with interesting Dylan scholars, academics, and fans. Find it at fmpods.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The American West is a place of lore and legend, of triumphs and tragedies. No one can tell the true stories of the West better than author Rick Stieber. And now there's a podcast showcasing his work. It's called Writing the West, and every episode will feature his short stories and his poetry. If you want to know the true stories of cowboys, pioneers, miners, and Native Americans, this 15-minute podcast is for you. Writing the West is available on Spotify, Audible, Podbean, or wherever you get your listening matter. That's Writing the West, the work of Rick Stieber. And there never was a man who was born with a gunner's hand who ever took a pan to Big Blue. Taking a pan, does that imply we're going to capture you and then we're going to cook you? What does that mean?
I actually Googled it, and it says, took a pan means to give a very negative review or criticism of something. So the only thing I can think of is there never was a man who could criticize the blue whale. That's what it means.
And at the same time, it means that they had to respect Big Blue or this blue whale because of his size, because he managed to live this long. I don't know. Certainly because of his size. So I think probably this is a very indirect way of saying that the whale earned the respect of any hunter that was around at that time. Now, the gray whale has run and the sperm is almost done. And that whole verse is about whaling and the damage it's done to ocean life. Blue whales are endangered, and I believe they've been endangered since 1970. You mentioned the three countries that still do the hunting, but I don't think they've ever gone off the endangered species list.
Yes, and just by comparison, I'm not sure of the year breakoff, but at their peak, there were 250,000 blue whales, and now there are 10 to 25,000 blue whales. And I've heard many times on our whale watch trips that if you see a blue whale, you are in 1% of the population of the world.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's impressive. But
99% of the population will never be able to see a blue whale.
And you have seen one, Deb. So
I've seen many, and I feel so gifted. And there was one in particular that I will never forget, and it was a junior whale. And he was curious about the boat. Of course, this junior whale is still 60 feet long. He came and went under our boat, and I was standing looking over the side. And when he went under, he turned on his side, and we made eye contact. And it was Amazing.
Did you play hard to get with the Whale?
Yeah, I would have jumped in with him if he'd let me.
Woo! Okay.
But yeah, only 1% of the population of the world will ever see a blue whale. And it is commercial whaling, but it's also things like climate change affecting the availability of krill, because krill only survives in certain water temperatures, vessel strikes in shipping lanes, fishing gear entanglements, pollution. Sometimes they find these dead whales and they open up their stomachs and they're just full of plastic bags and trash. So it isn't just whaling anymore, but that accounts for some of the lower number as well.
Yeah, and I think Gordon was talking about the idea of commercial whaling at that particular time. Yes. Although, as you said, we know now, we probably didn't know in 1972 as much, but certainly we know now that there's a huge amount of death of whales that is not as deliberate, or at least not as directly deliberate as it was when they were hunting them. They've been taken by the men for the money they could spend. And that's, I think, him being poetic again, because it's more like the money they could make. Nobody is going to spend that much time or have that much effort if they're not going to make a buck off of it.
That's
Which is sad, but that's a statement on human nature, I guess. Well, the song appeared on Don Quixote, which came out in 1972. The album got to number one in Canada and 42 in the US and 44 in the UK. I don't have any statistics on how it did in Australia and New Zealand. The song was not released as a single or as a B-side. It was the first song on side two of Don Quixote, which meant it was the seventh overall song on the record. There were 11 altogether. And we'll talk a little bit more about who played and how much got played. But I got to tell you that my favorite musical part of the song is Rick's bass line.
Absolutely.
And I don't think he's ever played a better bass line on any of Gord's songs than he did on this one, because it punched at exactly the right time and it backed off at exactly the right time. And I think Rick deserves enormous amounts of credit for that. And I dare say it's better than anything John Stockfish could have played. What's your favorite musical element in the song?
Oh, that's it. No doubt. It is magnificent. It's powerful. It's propelling. You can almost see the fish propelling through the water as his bass line is propelling the song. It's indispensable to that song. It's magnificent.
Yeah. And I don't know how much Rick had practiced that. And I don't know how much it was just coming straight from his soul to his fingers. But in any case, I give a whole lot of credit to Rick for making that come alive. He, of course, played bass on this. Gord played 6 and 12 string guitar. This is on the album I'm describing. Red playing high string guitar, which we can hear. Terry Clements was playing lead acoustic guitar. I think we can hear that. And then Rye Cooter played mandolin on the album, although I'm not sure if there is any mandolin on this song. I can't quite hear it.
I don't think it's on this song.
No, I don't think so either. But it might have been the harmonics were certainly high enough that they could have been from a mandolin, but you don't hear mandolin the same way that you would hear in bluegrass or something like that. Well, the song was played 74 times in concert. The first time was at Freeborn Hall in Davis, California on October 14th, 1971. And I have to say that UC Davis is my alma mater, and I have performed and sung and played in Freeborn Hall also.
Oh, wow.
That's kind of cool. The last time it was played was in August of 2002 at the William Saroyan Theater in Fresno, California. So, Deb, did you ever get to see him play it live in concert?
Several times.
What was that like?
It was one of those that as soon as he started playing it, you were like, oh, it was fabulous. And again, Rick's bass is just so powerful in this song. It's just a powerful song, and it was wonderful, but I've heard it several times.
There are four professional covers of it that I can find. Steve Rostron, Janet Russell, and Christine Kidd, Trout Fishing in America, and J.P. Cormier. And J.P.'s done other Lightfoot songs, of course. Now, Deb, with the understanding that you and I are both can take or leave most of the covers of Gord's songs, have you heard any of the covers? Do you have any thoughts on them?
I have not heard any of the covers at all. I'm sure they're fine, but nor do I really wish to.
It's fair. That's fair. But that also brings me to my last question.
Yeah.
Who would you want to hear cover this song that didn't cover it? And there's no one around today that I would like to hear cover it. But mm-hmm. I wish that Crosby and Nash had done it because they did that Critical Mass and Wind on the Water. And I think this would have fit in as a third element to that. And I would have liked to hear John Denver do it because that was right up his alley. And it was not unknown for him to cover other people's songs.
Right.
So that would have been fun to listen to. Is there anybody that you kind of think, you know, that it would be fun to listen to this person do that?
John Denver would certainly be on my list, although Gord's voice is so deep and resonant and John has this purity of voice, but I don't know. I would like to hear it. I don't know if he could carry it off. I would like to hear it because that is right in his alley. The only other one is Harry Chapin.
I don't know that Harry ever covered anybody else's song.
Yeah, I don't know either.
He wrote all of his own stuff and he was amazingly prolific. Well, unfortunately, we mentioned Crosby and Nash. We mentioned John Denver. We mentioned Harry Chapin and they're all gone.
I know.
Graham is still around, but you can't do the duo with just one person.
Right.
So maybe it's safe to say that we just leave that song alone and let Gord's version stand as it is.
Yeah, stand as it is.
Deb Radwan, this podcast would literally not exist without you. And I'm looking forward to a lot more adventures and some new ideas about what we're going to do in future podcasts. So thanks again for taking the time.
There's nothing I'd rather do than talk about Gordon's music. So it makes me happy.
And thanks for listening, everybody. If you like this well enough to listen to the whole thing, tell somebody about it. Carefree Highway Revisited is on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your listening matter. I'd like to make a special request for you to visit my Patreon page. I love this show so much, and I want to keep it going, and you're in a position to help. Please head over to www.patreon.com/carefreehighwayrevisited. A dollar or two a month is all I ask. You can reach me, Mike Messner, at teachermike72@gmail.com.
Well, the next episode will feature my guest, Neil Coate, and he and I will be talking about Rich Man's Spiritual, which was actually the very first song on the very first Lightfoot album back in 1966. And that episode will be coming out in February of 2024. Until then, for Deb Radwan, this is Mike Messner reminding you, run for the roses, but don't forget to stop and smell them. We'll see you next time.